Case number 07-5080, Scott Tooley, appellant versus George W. Bush, president et al. Ms. Bernstein for the appellant, Ms. Miller for the appellees.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Chief Judge Santel, and may it please the court. My name is Cassandra Bernstein, amicus presenting arguments on behalf of Scott Tooley. Mr. Tooley is here today. He's seated in the front row behind me. As you know, this court presented a question for supplemental briefing, and if I may, I'd just like to briefly identify the three issues I'd like to address with respect to that question.
First, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I just said, if I may, I'd like to briefly identify the three issues I'd like to address with respect to the question that this court presented. First, on a motion to dismiss for lack of standing, this court should apply the Rule 8 liberal pleading standards in assessing the complaint. Second, when allegations are pled on information and belief, they must not be treated any differently than allegations pled on direct personal knowledge. Here, the district court did precisely that, however, and as a result, Tooley's complaint was held to a de facto heightened pleading standard. And third, and this goes directly to the question that the court asked, if information is uniquely within the opposing party's control, this court should consider that when evaluating pleadings on information and belief. That's
on what? I'm just taking the third issue first. On the wiretapping, I mean, obviously, the people who did wiretapping, if they did it, would know, and that information is within the government's control. But when someone is alarmed about wiretapping, they do have devices, do they not, for applying tests to see whether it's going on, particularly if there's clicking and other indicia of something being amiss?
There may be, but at this pleading stage?
No, we're talking about you're invoking a special rule where information is a monopoly of the moving party, but I just don't see that there's that big a monopoly here.
Well, let's start with the special rule. I would suggest that it's not a special rule. It's within the liberal pleading standard of Rule 8.
So there's no point in talking about it. It's the basic proposition that the way Rule 8 is to be read.
I agree. I do think it's a basic proposition and consistent with Rule 8. However,
in fact, the government agrees with that also.
The government does, but here's the distinction. The Supreme Court and seven other courts of appeals have considered whether information is in the exclusive party within the control of the opposing party. And this court also has done it, not directly in this context, but in Browning, this court acknowledged it, and then in Cowell, which is a Rule 9b case, but this court actually stated that in the 9b context. And
you don't need the special rule you're arguing about, do you? Under your theory.
Correct.
So your theory is that your pleading is adequate under Rule 8a.
Exactly.
And the government agrees that that's the rule. So why do we have to deal with this issue?
Well, I think this is why. Well, first and foremost, of course, because this court presented it. So, of course, we want to address it. The government
did not engage in addressing
it, even though we spent a considerable part of our brief addressing it. But here's why I do think it's relevant, because even though the government and, in fact, the district court nominally agree with that standard, if you look at the district court's decision and you look at the pleadings that the government has put forth all along, they actually are applying a higher standard. Right. And in fact, one thing I think is relevant to note is this error was introduced by the government in its motion to dismiss. There, it framed its whole analysis about these pleadings on Cowell, which, as I just noted, was a 9B case. As you know, that's a heightened standard. And so basically what the government did, and they didn't repeat this error later, but they started this process that the district court ended up adopting, whereas they're saying you have to have these specific facts, and that's not what the Rule 8 standard is.
Yeah, I wonder, now I realize that I'm straying over into 12B6 to the 12B1.
Well, we'll let you do that because we do that too.
Pardon? Maybe we have to.
Right.
Where an allegation is made on its face of information and belief, and the face of the document makes it clear that there is no factual basis for that belief, is it really applying a higher standard to say that this is an inadequate allegation?
If there's
I grant you the normal treatment is on information and belief is treated the same as any other allegation, but it becomes evident here that belief is simply an act of faith on the part of the complainant rather than a belief based on any factual information.
Yes, well, courts actually, including this court, haven't really distinguished that. They have been generous in considering, even if it's pled on information and belief.
Suppose that he had alleged that the United States government, I believe the United States government is employing angels and devils to follow me around. Would the court have to accept that?
No, absolutely not. And I'll tell you why.
What is the difference in that and this?
I'll tell you why. It's this court's decision in Bess v. Kelly. There, this court drew a distinction between what is essentially fictitious and what's not. In fact, the court said there that essentially you accept any allegations unless they're flimsier than doubtful.
Yeah, and an allegation that my phone is being tapped, and I know it because there's clicking on the line. Phone taps don't cause clicking on the line. An allegation that I know I'm being spied on by the government because there was a car parked in front of my house, that's flimsy. Why isn't this properly treated as a fictitious or flimsy complaint rather than as if it were an allegation of fact?
For two different reasons. First, it's not just those allegations in standing separately. Remember, this all started because of a conversation with Southwest Airlines in this heightened 9/11 airport security context. And so there, you don't just have these bare allegations.
I'm not sure if the invocation of the conversation with Southwest helps you or hurts you, because if the clicking, let's accept the clicking momentarily. If it had started the next day or the next week, then it would somewhat shore up the claim. But if more than a year goes by, it seems to me it weakens the claim. It suggests we're not dealing with plausible inferences.
Well, 2 points on that. First, I think you're sharing the same rationale the district court shared, and I would just suggest that is too much scrutiny at this stage. This court and the Supreme Court have held in numerous cases that it's not for the district court to assess whether there may be evidence later down the road or to do that kind of second guessing. Well, maybe this doesn't make quite as much sense. I mean, here in this context, it's certainly plausible that the wiretapping actually occurred prior to the year that he first started hearing it. But also, again, this is right after 9/11, the largest restructuring of
the conversation was right after 9/11, but the alleged everything else is at least 18 months after the conversation, isn't it?
Well, he said at least a year, but again, there was the largest restructuring of the intelligence service then, and there's the government takes time for things to happen. I don't think that's an unreasonable inference. And just to get back to what the real standard here is, if it's not essentially fictitious, then the Supreme Court has said in Twombly, and this court said very recently in the Actisel-Skaba case, you look to see if the complaint puts the defendants on fair notice with circumstances and other indicia for them to be able to provide a responsive pleading. And I think clearly here, even if on some gut level, maybe that 1 year seems unreasonable, clearly that's enough information for the government to come forward with a responsive pleading.
How do you deal with United Presbyterian? And I'm thinking particularly of the text at 1380 and footnote 2, where we have the allegation by one of the appellants that it has been informed on numerous occasions of instances of mail sent by it, which has not reached the destination, and of mail sent to it, which was never received. And that, the court at least thought that was a correct application of, I'm not sure whether we're talking 12b1 or 12b6, but at any rate, and of Rule 8. So how is this less generalized and nonspecific? The court assumes there's a specificity requirement in Rule 8, which we're told is not right, but it did it then.
Well, the Supreme Court just said last year, in 5 words, specific facts are not necessary. That was in the Erickson case. Now, getting back to your original question, distinguishes...
The difficulty with that is that it was then purporting to apply Rule 8 as we've always known it, And so was United Presbyterian purporting to apply Rule 8 as we've always known it. In other words, that it's not a question of our having a recognized change in the standard. What we seem to have is varying requirements of specificity depending on something which is not disclosed by the panel.
Well, to your question about what's the difference, I think there are a couple of key differences. First, the court there was concerned that you'll see right before, right after footnote 2, even if they were more particularized, the allegations.
The court has an alternative theory, but at least in that sentence plus attached footnote,
right,
has one theory that it appears to regard as sufficient.
Right. Well, here the executive order that was being challenged, there was no allegation that these plaintiffs were actually subject to it. And in fact, a number of their allegations predated the existence of it.
That's a different issue, mm-hmm, right? But that's not the issue on which the court is relying at that passage.
Well, for that passage, their allegations are more passive and more vague. They say for a long time. They say a long-term pattern. Again, Tooley's complaint has dates. It's more authentic. It's a constellation of facts. It's not these more broad and general statements. And these are each, as far as we can tell, each plaintiff just has one of these little allegations that it's very vague.
Well, I mean, whatever it is, Episcopal Churchman of South Africa, mm-hmm, seems to have this pattern of outgoing and incoming mail not going where it's supposed to go. So, I mean, one response to what you say would be for the court to say everybody loses but Episcopal Churchmen of South Africa.
Well, I do think this is where it's relevant that the concern that the court seemed to have was with the subject, which was the executive order. The court didn't believe that these allegations matched that executive order, and it had this overriding concern that we've seen in a number of other cases like Halkin and Barr, which is the plaintiffs were challenging the entire national intelligence gathering authorization. And it seemed like on these very vague allegations, the court did not want to wade into that kind of inquiry. Here, of course, Tooley is just alleging it against him, and so I think the inquiry, he has better facts, but it's also a much more narrow inquiry for the court to consider.
What does he allege specifically? And this may or may not be an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What does he allege specifically that the defendants did to him as a fact? If we were using, we're looking at to analyze the facts that are there in the complaint. I know you don't want to use fact pleading, but what facts are there as to what the defendants are, have actually done that's tortuous or actionable?
He was searched in 2004 at an airport, but not in the kind of search that you and I go through when we go to the airport. His name was announced over the
Who did that? Who is alleged to have done that, to have called out his name in the airport, to have done an airport search?
TSA, because they're in charge of the airport security. That was one fact.
That would implicate the president, and let me see who all is the defendant.
The president's out.
It's now the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, which of course is above TSA and TSA itself. It gives credence to the federal action here. That I mean, you can look at that only in the airport context, but with the rest of his allegations, it's this federal context. And the district court did distinguish between his factual allegations. I believe the government said there are only three. But again, the case law tells us we don't distinguish those, that we read the complaint most favorably to him, and we do it in a way that treats pleadings on information and belief with just the same weight at the pleading stage as his factual allegations, because the facts are actually tested later on.
What would Twombly is not the clearest case in the world.
Right.
But
although this court did a good job trying to clarify it in the Actiesel-Scovett case.
Which case?
Twombly.
I'm sorry.
The D.C. Circuit case, German name, very difficult to pronounce.
Well, the government took the smarter approach and called it Fame Jeans, which is the opposing party. But we stuck with the Danish, the Actiesel-Scovett case. That was the case where this court said, we've looked at all the other circuits have said, and we are saying that Twombly did not change the notice pleading standard.
But what I want to go back to in Twombly is it did express and it seemed to be the driving concern in Twombly, that with a different approach, useless and very costly discovery would be licensed. So if you win here, what do you picture as the discovery that you would then be entitled to?
I think it would be extraordinarily different than the Twombly discovery. There, of course, the plaintiffs were suing the local exchange carriers that provided 90% of the service to 48 states. So it was this massive undertaking. They alleged it over a 7-year period with no dates whatsoever. So the discovery there was going to be this enormous process. Here we have one person with a...
You have no names here, do you, of defendants? You have only the theoretical liability of the heads of the departments. You don't have anything about who did what as far as any individual. We'd still be looking at the broad range of all the possible discovery within a large department, wouldn't we?
I think it would be more narrow because these are the agencies that do, when you think of national security and watch listing and those sorts of claims, and it's one person with a narrow time frame with narrow allegations. It's not this sort of fishing expedition that concerned the court in a lot of these other cases, including in Twombly. So to answer your question, what would discovery look like? I think the district court could manage it.
Quick and simple.
Yes. If there are no further questions, then...
Let me ask you one specific, claim-specific question. As to the watch list, what is the harm that is supposed to... Why is it actionable if his name was on the harms list? What's his harm from that?
Well, the harms, first of all, most immediate, is that every time he goes into an airport now, he's subject to detention and search. And so he...
That's that action. That's at least independent in some sense from being on the watch list per se.
Yeah, per se.
I don't think so, because his allegations are not that he's subject to screening, what we go through. His allegations are that he's actually detained and subject to...
But as far as being on a watch list, how is that in and of itself any harm to him?
Well, if it could give rise to him being put on other watch lists.
Well, could give rise to is not the sort of thing we usually consider in standing or cause of action or claim for relief analysis, is it? Could give rise to. That's speculation. How is he actually harmed by being on a watch list, per se?
Well, besides that there is this actual him going into the airport and having to deal with this, there's a stigma of being associated on a watch list.
How is there a stigma to being put on a secret list?
Because it's not secret, because he's publicly detained and searched.
That's a different question. I'm talking about the watch list. I'm not talking about whether he's publicly detained and searched. I'm talking about just being on a watch list.
Well, I suppose if you separate the two,
I'm asking you to do, yes.
Okay, then perhaps it would be difficult to assert a harm just from having his name on there alone, but I think they go together. And the Ninth Circuit's very, very recent decision in Ibrahim, this is one dealing with non-TSA watchlist versus TSA watchlist, but it goes through that kind of concern. There, the plaintiff had also alleged a number of constitutional violations, and the Ninth Circuit ended up treating it as an APA claim to get an injunction to have the name removed for a lot of the same reasons that Tooley's alleged.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, I'm sorry, did you have a question?
No. Okay. No, I don't. Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Teal Luthie Miller from the Department of Justice on behalf of the federal defendants. As the inquiry this morning suggests, at the heart of this case is the treatment of inferential allegations in a complaint on a motion to dismiss. And
it was really inferential allegations. I mean, that was at the center of Twombly in a kind of special way, to be sure. But what does it have to do with inferences when you're talking about the wiretapping and the risking and the officer and the Crown Victoria?
Well, Your Honor, I think this court's cases have distinguished between specific alleged facts and facts based on inferences. And I think Twombly is relevant to that, but other cases also discuss it. And the question is, what does he allege specifically based on his personal knowledge? And then what does he infer has happened based on those?
I see. So you're saying, okay, so there's been the clicking, et cetera, mm-hmm. and the frisking, and you're saying that doesn't give rise to any inference about activities by these defendants.
I think that's right. It doesn't. The question in Twombly, but under normal notice pleading standards, is whether the specific alleged facts are adequate to make the inferences or the ultimate allegations plausible. And the reason the district court properly dismissed this case is because.
What about the special higher level frisking, et cetera, at airports?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at his
that
allegations.
That is something the TSA manages, right?
It is, Your Honor. His allegation says that he is detained every time he travels, or stopped and searched every time he travels. He doesn't say how many times he's traveled. He only
describes. Why does he have to? We have to accept that allegation is true, don't we?
Yes.
That's a truth. That's a fact that's true for purposes of our discussion today.
That he has stopped.
That he has stopped every time he travels.
Yes, it is. Right. I agree, okay. Your Honor.
Why does it make any difference that he doesn't tell us how many times he travels?
Well, Your Honor, it goes to whether it's evidence of his being placed on a no-fly or selectee list, on a TSA
watch. Well, I can understand that, you know, that would be relevant later at summary judgment, perhaps. But we're at the pleading stage here.
That's right, Your Honor. But I think even if he has alleged, properly alleged, that he has been stopped every time and that force suggests he has standing to assert a claim that he's on a watch list, the watch list claim is subject to the exclusive review of the Court of Appeals, and placement on a watch list
well,
by
he,
itself
he claims
isn't evidence
he,
that supports
he claims there. He claims there were other watch lists. He alleges that.
But the only injury he's pointed to is placement on the TSA watch list. All the other allegations are allegations of a bigger program of surveillance.
Let's go back, though. We have this, let's call it super frisking at the airports, right?
Yes.
So that's a harm.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so that looks good for standing.
Let me back up from that concession a little bit. I don't believe it is based on precedents discussing search and seizure, going through a metal detector, having your bag searched.
Maybe a perfectly legal harm, but it's a harm.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. So then the question is the connection to these defendants. And why isn't the inference, let's forget about the watch list altogether, but why isn't the inference as to Homeland Security, making some reasonable assumptions about authority, why isn't the inference that has something to do with decisions made by DHS?
I think we have to accept that inference at this stage of the case. However, I want to make...
So what's missing?
Well, first of all, it doesn't support the inference of the general program of surveillance, which is a...
Let's forget about
that. Why not?
Okay. Okay, then if
you have the injury and we have a arguably plausible connection to at least one of the defendants.
Then I think the question is, this court's order calling for additional briefing stated that to the extent he was challenging the inclusion of his name on a TSA watch list, that question was within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals and he had to file a petition.
Let's forget about that. Let's focus on injury, plausible connection to at least one defendant. Why isn't it enough?
Well, it is enough as to the claim that he has been placed on a TSA watch list. But the only...
No, please. You really like to talk about that. I don't like to talk about that.
Okay.
I just want to the injury, which is certainly asserted, and see whether we get... there's any way of possibly getting to the defendants. It looks to me as if there's a way of getting to one defendant. I'm not sure about the other two.
I don't think it gets you to the other defendants because...
I think I agree. It's weak on the other two.
It's weak on the other defendants. It doesn't support any of his allegations concerning a more general program of surveillance applying
to him and his siblings and his parents. But why is that? The plaintiff argues that the allegations of physical surveillance, the stopping at the airports and the Crown Victoria outside the house, that those allegations make his allegations of wiretapping more plausible. That it's perfectly appropriate to infer from the fact that if they're if he's being stopped at airports and if they've got a car parked outside his house that has a federal official in it, that it's more likely than not that he is being wiretapped also.
I don't think it is, but even if it is incrementally more likely.
But don't we have to make those inferences in his favor at this point?
I don't think so. And I don't think so because of Twombly, but also because of notice pleading standards, which is what inferences are reasonable. Is it reasonable to infer that based on being stopped and put into secondary screening, that you've come to the government's attention such to the extent that it would dedicate this sort of attention and resources to searching or to surveilling not just you, but your siblings, your parents, your in-laws?
But there are other allegations he makes. I mean, he says he had this conversation with a Southwest ticket agent, which we have to accept is true, and that and it's perfectly appropriate to infer from that conversation that she must have reported him, right? I mean, that's a pretty...
I believe that's an appropriate inference.
That's an appropriate inference.
And, with the caveat that we don't have to infer that she appropriated it as a grave threat.
No, but that she somehow reported him, and so from that it's really not much of a stretch to infer that maybe there's something to what he heard on his telephone, which is supported by the allegations of physical surveillance. I mean, isn't it sort of logical to think that if they're following you around, it's more likely, it increases the plausibility of your claim that you're also being wiretapped?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because I think it's not consistent with what we know about the world.
We're dealing with the complaint here.
Well, I don't think that the allegation that the government pays attention to you in one area is consistent or makes it more likely that the government pays attention to you in other areas of your life,
I would hope, to be clear. I would hope the government would.
Well, Your Honor, I'd also add that the district court wasn't required to ignore the FOIA decision that she made in this case. She approved a government search of the Department of Justice's records, which included a search of all the records, the Criminal Division and the Federal Bureau of Investigation's records concerning electronic surveillance, and came up with no responsive
documents.
Yeah, but
this we're not at summary judgment here. The only thing we have is a complaint.
Well, I don't believe that the district court was required to ignore the judicially established facts concerning the FOIA research.
That's the problem. Maybe she was.
Yeah.
Maybe she was required to ignore that. If you're looking under notice pleading, you're normally, if you want to use the word, ignoring everything but the pleadings. And you're looking at a 12B1, or even a 12B6.
Well, Your Honor, the Haas...
Don't bring up the doctrine that you can plead yourself out of a case by putting in unnecessary material that undercuts your claim.
That's right, but this court's decision in Haas, which considers a claim by a freelance journalist returning to the United States that he's been subject to a policy where the government stops everyone returning to Nicaragua, goes through notice pleading standards and standing and a motion to dismiss. And it says the court can investigate facts to decide whether they're standing at the notice to dismiss stage. And I think the district court appropriately looked to the FOIA
really
decision.
Is this a standing case? I know the district court used that rubric, but if the allegations are accepted as true, then at least as to maybe the search claim, there would be some harm, wouldn't there? Isn't she more treating it as a 12B6 rather than a 12B1, although using the rubric of standing?
I certainly think it's possible to see her decision that way, although what she ultimately concluded was that the allegations of harm were so implausible that they didn't give standing.
Didn't the government move to dismiss for lack of standing, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Was that the only ground asserted by the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And why did the government do that instead of just a standard 12B6?
Because the allegations of standing were weak, not just to the claim of injury, but to the claim of causation. If you look carefully at the complaint, for example, the statement that someone was outside my house in a car isn't tied to, it says an officer. It doesn't say a federal officer, and it doesn't say
one of
the defendants.
Aren't I right that didn't you concede somewhere? I thought I saw in your brief that you said that you could infer from that it was a federal officer, right?
I don't know whether we made that concession in our brief.
You did.
certainly the reply brief suggests that inference is reasonable. Right. But they haven't sued the circuit. He hasn't sued the Secret Service. So the Secret Service. He hasn't.
The plaintiff's complaint is that what you're doing is that you're looking at each individual allegation separately. And their point is that when you look at them all together, they increase the plausibility of their complaint about electronic eavesdropping, wiretapping. And that when you're reading a complaint, you can't just compartmentalize every allegation. You can't look at the Crown Victoria outside the house in isolation. You have to look at it in context of a complaint that also includes complaints about noises on telephones and radio tags in the car, right? Which is a factual allegation, which we have to accept as true, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. There are two sides to that coin. It is also true that when you look at the complaint as a whole, you have to look at whether it is the surveillance alleged is so pervasive that it undermines the credibility of the other allegations. And I think that's true in this case. He's alleging...
Wait, I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
You look at... It is appropriate to look at each of the facts alleged,
right.
and I think there are basically five facts alleged in this case, and I can go through them if you'd like, and ask what do they add up to. You also then look at the picture that they add up to and say, not just working together do they support each other, but also working together do they undermine themselves. And working together, the facts in this case do undermine themselves, because the ultimate conclusion is that as a result of what is an ambiguous comment to a private party, we're supposed to infer that ambiguous comment was reported to the government. The government considered it a grave threat and instituted a 4-year program of subjecting plaintiff to surveillance.
Isn't that what we're supposed to do at the motion to dismiss stage? We accept the complaint's allegations as true.
We accept the factual.
And we give, right, I'm sorry, you're correct about that. Their factual allegations as true.
Yes.
And you agree that the allegations about the Southwest ticket office, the noises on the telephone, the radio tagging and the police car and the searches at the airport, they're your five, right?
Yes.
Okay. You agree those are all facts?
I do.
We have to accept that they're true, and we have to give all inferences from those facts in the plaintiff's favor. And you just agreed with me. Plausible. And you just agreed with me that you have to look at all of them together. You can't just isolate each one of them. Correct?
That's right, Your Honor, although you also have to look at exactly what's said. For example, someone put a tracking device on my car. He never alleges that it was the government. And it's isolating that allegation to say, let's look at specifically what it says.
Why would he be suing the government if he wasn't alleging that it's the government who put the radio tags on there?
Well, again, he hasn't alleged that. I'd also note that he alleges he is in possession of additional evidence of government surveillance that he doesn't know.
I'm not even considering that. I agree with you. We can't consider that.
Okay.
I totally agree with that.
If this court believes that the status of these sort of inferences are unclear, I would note that next week the Supreme Court is hearing Ashcroft against Iqbal, which Ashcroft against Iqbal, IQBAL, which is number 071015. And in that case, similar questions about what you have to say at the motion to dismiss stage and inferential allegations are presented. So
you think
it might be appropriate
wait
to
see
hold.
What the court says about that?
I think that might be appropriate. Yes, Your Honor. Uh-huh.
What would your answer be to my question about discovery and Twombly's concern with that? And to put it another way, is plaintiff's counsel wrong in her characterization of distinctions between the discovery that was on the horizon there and the discovery that might occur here?
I think she is in the following sense, that if... Mr. Tooley has stated a claim that entitles him to discovery, then pretty much anyone can. And the government would be facing a large burden of discovery based on these types of allegations, even if the discovery in a particular case might not be as vast as the discovery in Twombly.
Seeing no further questions.
We would ask the judgment of the court.
Thank you, counsel. I'm sure that petitioner or appellant's time was up. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
A few quick points in my limited time. I'm not familiar with the case that counsel was speaking about for next week in the Supreme Court.
Not either.
But I would just say that I think we have plenty of law and plenty of recent law from both the Supreme Court and the D.C. Circuit that would allow you to reverse the district court without waiting for that.
What do you say to her answer to my question about your answer on discovery?
Well, I would say that the Supreme Court in the Swickizet case and this court in Sparrow was not concerned about the discovery issue.
Court Twombly clearly was concerned about
that. Right, and I think that was because of that gloss of that extreme discovery and the fact that the court said there was not even a clue to give the defendants any information on which they could make a responsive pleading. It was just no facts that could even suggest an inference, and so the court didn't want to open up the entire industry to this kind of discovery.
Colleague argues that if these allegations are sufficient, then everybody and his brother can make something pretty similar, and so it collectively adds up to a huge amount of discovery.
Well, I think there are a few reasons why that shouldn't be a concern to you. First of all, if we're applying the notice pleading standard, that's what we're here to do. If the government is worried about the burden, then the procedure for that in the federal rules is to take care of it either through other motions or later on in the process. But it's no reason to exclude a plaintiff's complaint now.
We know from Twombly, mm-hmm. at least in some cases, it has an impact on how the Supreme Court reads Rule 8.
Right, but there are other cases where the Supreme Court has read Rule 8E to do substantial justice that don't have that antitrust gloss that Twombly has. So I would suggest those cases are more similar here. And in Sparrow, in this court's case, Judge Carlin made very clear that even if district courts see a burden of cases and want to move them because they don't feel like they're meritorious, it's not for the court to apply a heightened pleading standard. It still goes back to the notice pleading standard, and there are other ways to deal with a concern about discovery and an influx of litigation. And lastly, I would just argue that the government in its brief never made any argument about a concern of additional discovery or litigation.
Seeing no further questions and your red light being on, the case will be submitted. Ms. Bernstein, you accepted the court's invitation to appear as amicus with the court. The court thanks you for your service in this matter.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Give us recess.
Stand, please.